Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from the kitchen tap. I love my cooker. It's a very cool device, I think. As well as being cool, it's also environmentally friendly as it keeps the water hot in a vacuum and doesn't have to keep reheating it like the little old kettle does. I've no idea how the vacuum works, but it sounds very modern. Just a reminder though, mine does filtered water and sparkling filtered water too, both chilled. If you can afford it, I recommend it. For more details and to look at all the models, go to cooker.co.uk. This podcast is also sponsored by Unthin, which is a hair loss treatment. People who follow me on social media know that I'm using this. It contains the two ingredients that help with hair loss. It's a lotion that you apply every morning and every night. There are no pills involved in this. This is an awkward thing for me to promote, as I would hate to help sell something that doesn't work. I've been using it for 4 months now, and I think my hair is coming back. My friends have said this too. When I touch it, there seems to be a much more hair there than there used to be. If you are interested though, and you're worried about taking the plunge just yet, wait a few more months and just watch me, as the chemist who made this stuff tell me, it's from the 3 to 4 month period that you can really start seeing the results. I must tell you though, it is a long process. The proper results will take up to about 12 months. It's quite a, I want to use the word weak, but I'm sure the chemist would hate that, but it's not that powerful. It just will do the job, but it does it slowly. If you are interested, use the code LOVEJOY10 for the first month for £10. Let's go to unthin.co.uk, UNTHIN. When asked for the code, use LOVEJOY10, that's the number 10, and get the first month for £10. But as I say, you can watch me on social media and on TV and see if it's actually working. Today's Lovejoy Hour, I'm going back over familiar ground for my regular listeners as I find out more about drugs in our society. This week, I'm curious about people trying to help drug users. I think it's easier for people, maybe like me, I don't know, who never come into contact with people with hard drug dependency, to just think of these people as bad people. They're bad. They take drugs and I don't. And they like hard drugs they're taking. The government makes us also believe they're criminals as well, which since I've been talking about drug reform, I just think it's a really nasty thing to do, actually. But even if you don't have empathy for people who are using these drugs, drug addiction, you know, drug addiction has an impact on everyone in society. So today I've invited a couple of people on the podcast to discuss this. They're both working with a charity, Cranstone. It's a social justice and harm reduction charity working across the areas of substance use, domestic abuse, criminal justice, housing, and young people. They believe inspiring and empowering people to live healthier and safer lives. The two people I'll be speaking to is Meg Jones. She's Director of New Business and Services. Meg has experiences across both private and public sector with expertise in policing, policy, and social justice. And Peter Krykant, who's a project lead for the charity, working on ways to implement solutions across the UK to help reduce deaths and harms associated with drug use. He previously set up and operated an overdose prevention centre in Glasgow, although the service was unsanctioned. It received both national and international recognition and saved lives. Okay, let me stop talking and meet them and they can tell us all about it. Here's Meg and Peter. Hi, Meg.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good. Hi, Peter, how are you?
I'm very well, Tim, thanks. Are you good?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Meg, let's start with you. Tell us a bit about the charity and your role.
Yeah, so I'm Director for New Business Services at Cranstone, and Cranstone is a social justice and harm reduction charity. We believe that, you know, we can empower people and empower change, both in terms of people themselves, but also within the structures that we're hoping to change in terms of drug reform. but also in terms of the legal structures that exist to support people who use drugs in this country.
How bad is the problem at the moment out there, Meg?
Huge, really. We've got drug related deaths at an all time high, and you know, not only then does that mean every single death is not just that individual, but a family that's impacted, friends that are impacted, but also the wider impact of that, which is, you know, we are faced with a reality in which, you know, one, people are dying, but also the levels of you know, criminality associated with people, unfortunately, who are not being supported and having to often delve into perhaps even drug dealing themselves to support that addiction, but also a range of sort of serious acquisitive crime that comes with that as well, is a huge societal cost and impact. And we know there's a better way of doing that. There's a better way of engaging with people, and there's a better way of reducing that cost, crime and harm to taxpayers and to people in this country.
Yeah, I just said on my intro that people like me, and I have been, I definitely was this person years ago, where you just look at all people who are addicts or, you know, dependent on hard drugs as really just bad people. And I think the government's given us the indication over many decades that they are criminals. They're bad people and they're criminals, and we should be treating them like they are. Is that changing at all? I mean, I think the question is that, you know, I think people have to realize this. We can't just sort of push these people away. It impacts all of us, doesn't it? As you just mentioned there, the whole of society.
It does. And, you know, you're absolutely right. There's this kind of approach, isn't there, of, well, just don't do it. You know, just don't do drugs. And if that had worked over the past 50 years, then we wouldn't have all-time records, you know, drug-related deaths. And so we are really focused on having conversations about that with people across the political spectrum, with the public, about, you know, so we do talk a lot, and we've first and foremost put people's lives first, because that's a tragedy in of itself. But also it's about getting people to realise that there are pragmatic, practical solutions to this, which are not, you know, rocket science. They're not, you know, wholly kind of radical things. They're things that can be implemented now and are implemented in some areas that can start to change this and start to reverse, you know, the ongoing situation. And, you know, you've interviewed people like Steve Rolls before from Transform, and those sorts of organisations have done some fantastic work on assessing public attitudes. And actually, overwhelmingly, public attitudes across the UK at the moment is supportive of, you know, a changing approach to drug policy. And I think we just need the kind of the law, political attitudes to now catch up with public opinion.
Yeah, I only think that, though, if people have actually heard like podcasts like mine, or listened to Steve Rolls or Neil Woods, or read their books and stuff. Because I think generally, whenever I mention to my friends, I say, look, we need drug reform. This stuff needs to, we stop criminalizing drugs. And all these, they just look so shocked, because we've been brainwashed ever since we were born into believing everything to do with drug dependency, everything to do with any of it is just horrible, dark, evil, even though majority of the country have probably indulged themselves in some form of legal job. Peter, let's have a quick chat with you, move on to you. Tell us your background then, because you, I mean, fascinating what you got involved in.
Yeah, so speaking as somebody who was a former homeless injecting drug user, you know, I can certainly say that we're not bad people. You know, we're not people who should be pushed out of society. Often, people like myself and many people that I work with today have had these experiences. You know, we see people coming out of the armed forces. We see people coming from experiences of really adverse childhood experiences, you know, trauma, etc., that has led to, you know, that drug use in the first place. So it is really about providing a supportive system that enables people who are problematic drug users to address those underlying issues. But also on the wider aspect, you know, we've mentioned Steve Rolls, we've mentioned Neil Woods, you know, people And organisations are actually recognising now that most drug use is not problematic, you know, that it just needs to be conducted in as safer way as possible, you know, very much like alcohol, you know, regulated and controlled in a way that's safe for people to use it. You know, we've got other organisations out there now, like We Are The Loop, who are checking drugs at festivals, you know, to keep people safe from the contaminated supply that's distributed through criminal gangs at the moment that we currently rely on. When I got involved in doing this work, my background's in sales, and I only got involved in doing this work about 3.5 years ago. I very quickly, you know, through researching and looking at the work being done by people like Neil Woods, recognised that our system was completely broken. So what I did very quickly after getting involved in this work is went and got an ambulance and drove it into Glasgow City Centre and ran the UK's first unsanctioned drug consumption facility, allowing people who are some of the most marginalised people in our society, you know, homeless, injecting drug users who are normally hiding in alleyways, you know, and injecting in really in conditions that are just, you know, you know, you wouldn't want any family member or friend to be left in those conditions. So I provided them with a safe space, you know, and the levels of engagement and the levels of appreciation from people who use the service just absolutely blew me away. You know, just that little bit of dignity and that little bit of support that we offered, and really pushing for political change. And, you know, like Meg said, it's time for the government to catch up with the evidence out there internationally from other countries that have decriminalised and made drug use something that's more acceptable in society.
Peter, what does a safe space mean? Were you helping them get the drugs?
No, people would bring their own drugs. So, you know, the drug consumption facility or overdose prevention site is very much based on allowing people to bring their own drugs, but just providing that sterile environment. So giving clean injecting equipment, making sure that people are on hand to give harm reduction advice. So safer injecting practices to minimise injecting related wounds. And also, crucially, being on hand in the event of an overdose. So over the 10 months that we operated the site in Glasgow, we dealt with a number of overdoses. Had those overdoses occurred in the alleyways or in the parks, you know, those people could be dead just now. So, you know, that's the key issue here is in terms of reducing drug-related deaths. These sites are proven to work. There's hundreds of them across the world now, helping other countries deal with not just reducing drug deaths, but also all the associated harms. And I'm sure you're aware, Glasgow currently has the highest outbreak of HIV that the UK has seen in over 30 years. These sites eliminate those issues.
So I'm trying to get my head around. You've got an ambulance. They're not very big. How many people have you got in the ambulance taking drugs at any one time?
So the ambulance would provide enough room for three people to inject drugs at one time, three people at a time. So there was three medical seats within the ambulance. Obviously, in terms of being fit for purpose, in terms of Glasgow specifically, which is probably the city in Europe that needs an overdose prevention site more than any other, you know, it could often be busy. We would have three people in the ambulance injecting drugs, and then sometimes we'd have three people waiting outside and another three people behind them. So obviously not fit for purpose, but my ambulance was never to provide a space for an estimated 500 plus people out publicly injecting drugs every day in Glasgow. It was to push for political change, you know, and I think we were successful in that. You know, the Scottish Government have now said that they're going to open a site without waiting on the UK government or Boris Johnson to say so.
I'm going to ask some really stupid questions. I hope you don't mind, but I think there'll be a lot of people listening to this who have no understanding of what taking drugs is like myself. How long does it last if you're going to inject heroin?
It's ranging. I mean, it depends on tolerance levels, how much you consume, and the way in which you consume it as well. From person to person, it can be very variable. most of the time, people who were using or injecting in the site in Glasgow, within 5 minutes after injection, they would be ready to get up and leave.
Oh, okay. So, because I mean, look, I'm being so naive here, but you know, you watch Trainspotting or something, which is where a lot of us got our drug education from, and it's like, and that sort of thing, and it feels like it's like an hour's process where you know you just end up going into a, you know, into the zone for an hour or so, or you know, half an hour maybe. That's not the case.
I think for people who are newer, who are not longer term users, that can be the case. You know, they can often have that longer period of time. But if somebody's got that high tolerance level and they've been using substances like heroin or any opiate based substance for a long period of time, the impacts will lessen over periods of time.
So why would you were a user? My language is probably horrible here, by the way. I'm probably saying all the wrong things. But you were dependent on heroin at some stage, were you, in your life?
Yeah, I was dependent on heroin from about the age of 18. I got involved in heroin, and by the age of 19, I was street homeless, living on the streets of Birmingham. A daily heroin and crack cocaine user, intravenous crack cocaine user. I spent a number of years dependent on drugs in one form or another. But that, I suppose, was the reason that pushed me into going and opening the unsanctioned drug consumption room, because that was over 20 years ago that I was living on the streets of Birmingham, injecting in horrible conditions. You know, at that point, there was already countries opening these types of facilities and providing these health interventions for people. Fast forward 20 odd years later, the UK still doesn't provide these facilities.
What sort of conditions lead to someone to start taking heroin or crack cocaine in the first place?
Well, for me personally, I think it's variable again for different people. For me personally, my childhood was quite chaotic in many ways. You know, I recently looked through my school reports, which my mum has up her loft, and my primary 1 5-year-old school report, my teacher wrote on there that I was quarrelsome and unhappy and needed to mature a bit. And that kind of set the tone for the rest of my life. You know, I was always quarrelsome, unhappy, and needed to mature a bit. But I think a 5-year-old child, a teacher said, certainly wouldn't write that about a 5-year-old child now. I hope they wouldn't write that. But, you know, that was a reflection of what was going on in my home life and what was going on in the environment around me. You know, I was brought up in a very staunch Protestant environment where it was it wasn't seen as right to be anything other than heterosexual white Protestant, you know, and if you were anything other than heterosexual white Protestant, there was something wrong with you. And there was that whole sort of, as I say, you know, adverse experiences growing up, which when I started taking alcohol and other drugs, allowed me to escape from those experiences. And it was something that I think at points saved my life, you know, like in terms of how I felt about myself and how I felt about my life. Drugs saved me and allowed me to forget about a lot of that. And really, you know, the criminal justice system, which I was involved in at a really young age, it just made things worse, you know, and ultimately what I needed was social psychological support and an ability to engage with people to understand and deal with those issues.
So just going back a bit, that drugs saved you. It means your life was so horrific that it took the edge off the life. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think so. I mean, just if you look at it within society, you know, alcohol and other drugs are very much a social, you know, thing that people do to enjoy themselves. You know, like most people come home if you've had a hard day at work, have a couple of glasses of wine, it takes the edge off. For me, it was much more ingrained, you know. It was about taking the edge off, not a stressful day at work, the edge off a stressful life. And if you're taking the edge off a life that has so much trauma and hardship within it, you know, you're often wanting to do that more and more and more. And I think that's when you can come to become dependent. And if you've not got the support systems around you in order to manage and deal with those dependency issues, it leads into long-term problems.
Meg, is this what you face? What sort of people, what sort of profile of people do you come across who are drug dependent? Is it generally people who have had troubled backgrounds?
It's a whole range, but absolutely our response has to be trauma informed, because unfortunately, you know, the story that Peter tells is quite common. And, you know, that's the sad reality of, you know, I think there's often been a previous assumption that, again, you know, just don't do drugs, and a very simplistic way of looking at it. But actually, everything we do has to be person-centered. It has to be about what's going on in the life of that individual. And that's, you know, the use of the drug often is just the consequences of a lot of other things, you know, going on. And that's not to say, you know, we work in a range of areas, you know, some which is really problematic drug use and people wanting help and support into treatment. But also we work on the other end of the spectrum with young people who use drugs recreationally, and that's a very different intervention, and it's a very different use of the drug itself. So it's a huge range of people. It really is.
So what's the difference between recreational, though? I mean, I assume you start recreational drugs and then you find it's a way of leaving your life again, and otherwise you're not going to have that dependency, are you? I mean, I think the word I'm using the word dependency, and I assume that's the word that's when your life becomes dependent on the drug, and that's when the problems happen.
I think the way I would explain it back is that, you know, it's like alcohol. So many of us will have a drink on a Friday night, you know, go out on a Saturday night, and we'll never become addicted to that drug, which it is. And it's exactly the same with drugs, is that many people will use drugs recreationally or for a range of reasons and never become addicted. That's probably the best way of explaining it as well. But actually, often we find with the people that we work with on alcohol addiction, it's often very similar stories in terms of, you know, the trauma experiences of, you know, adverse childhood experiences that are key to some of that.
Big question to ask you here, Meg, but if drugs are saving people, which is, you know, a big statement, you know, is society broken?
It's a big question. I think right now, I think society is broken in this sense of, you know, our approach to drugs. I think what we have done is not learn from the last 50 years of trying to do the same thing and expecting a different outcome, which is, you know, we tell our young people don't do drugs. And, you know, that does not work. So instead, what we do with some of our diversion schemes, for example, is we engage young people and we say to them, here's some information about drugs. Here's harm reduction advice if you are going to take a drug. And people can make their informed choices and decisions off the back of that with all of the information in front of them. And actually, we find that reduces drug use considerably. It arms people with that information. And, you know, we have to start to do things differently. We have to start as society to approach this an issue much differently than we have done for the past 50 years.
Yeah, I always think that's weird because you keep mentioning alcohol there and it's like, don't do drugs, they're bad. Yeah, you can go and get yourself absolutely hammered on alcohol whenever you like. That's fine. And it's actually part of our culture. It's acceptable. And we like to praise it. We like to advertise it on TV. Everyone loves a drink. If any form of celebration happens, you know, oh, let's have a drink to celebrate it. Let's do that. Or, you know, I'm going to go and watch football today. I tell you what, let's watch it drunk. It's mental. It's absolutely insane the way we treat alcohol. And yet every other drug, bad, evil, you know, you're bad people doing it. Peter, getting back to you, another very, very clumsy question. But what does it feel like when you're actually taking the drug? How does it feel? That, because obviously at some stage you have to weigh it up, that you're saying you have to do horrible things down alleys, or, you know, but it's worth it for that feeling. So what is that feeling feel like?
Yeah, I suppose it's like a release. You know, that's the thing when we talk about alcohol, like you've just said, you know, alcohol is a drug that's been celebrated for generations now, you know, and a drug that, you know, actually, when you're intoxicated on alcohol, you can do some really silly things. You know, you can get aggressive, you can get sad, you can get, you know, lots of different adverse impacts of alcohol. Whereas drugs in general, the whole range of drugs which have been classified as illegal for, you know, over 50 years now in the UK, most drugs don't cause the adverse reactions that alcohol do. Can you imagine if we actually regulated all those substances, you know, and we made them, you know, controlled by proper content control, so people knew exactly what they were taking, you know, like we could have such a better society to live in, you know, because we wouldn't have to rely on these criminal gangs that are constantly feeding out these, you know, I'm sure you've heard of the street benzodiazepine problem in Scotland, you know, where benzodiazepines are responsible for over 800 deaths, or linked to over 800 deaths in Scotland. I mean, we talk about the UK wide.
Peter, I'm sorry, I don't know what that is. Can you tell me what it is?
So benzodiazepines are a drug that was readily prescribed in the UK, throughout the UK, just over 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Now they're not prescribed. You know, they're often a drug that are prescribed for anxiety, that type of thing.
Right.
They were readily prescribed to people who had dependency issues. And then about 10 or 12 years ago, we stopped prescribing those drugs. So it created this illicit market. It created a gap in the market for the drug gangs to come in and exploit. And now in Scotland, as I say, over 800 people a year now, deaths are directly linked to these street benzodiazepines, which are essentially made in flats in places like Glasgow, you know, distributed as little as 20 pence a pill to people, and nobody has any content control. The primary drug is a benzodiazepine called Atizolam, which is in that tests about 10 times stronger than prescription diazepam. So of course people are going to overdose quite easily and readily with on those drugs. But I mean, I don't know if that answers the question, but in terms of as a drug user, drugs for me are really nice. You know, I enjoy taking drugs, and you know, I think that's the issue. People are always going to enjoy taking drugs. The biggest problem for me about drugs is the prohibition of drugs. You know, I think most research out there from the World Health Organization and research from organizations like Drug Science says that about 90% of people who use substances don't ever experience problematic use with them. It's that 10% of people who do experience problems, just very much like alcohol, who need that extra support, who need that help, that social psychological support, or prescribing services to take away, again, the dangers of the illicit drug market and be on a safe supply of medication.
What happened when you set up your ambulance? What did the police say? What did the authorities say?
Well, I was a little bit concerned the first time I drove into Glasgow City Centre with this van saying I'm going to do something which at that point was framed as illegal. Whether the you know, I was parked right next to residential properties and businesses, whether people were going to come out with pitchforks and, you know, chase me away, what the police were going to do. It was all a major concern, but the police kind of monitored it, and then, you know, they actually stepped back from it, and I chatted with scores of frontline police officers, and on a one-to-one basis, obviously not something that they could say publicly, because they are serving officers. The general consensus was that the Misuse of Drugs Act is so outdated, they can't work with it anymore. They see the same people revolving in and out of the police system constantly, the criminal justice system constantly. At one point, I was charged. I was charged with obstruction in the course of a search when there was three homeless people in the back of my van. And a rather over-exuberant sergeant one day decided, I think of his own accord, to come and try and gain access to the van. Allegedly, I refused access until the drugs had been consumed, because at the point of consumption, there is no nothing illegal anymore because the drugs have been consumed, so there's not even a possession there. But later that charge was dropped because the public outcry, you know, there was such a big public outcry after the police charged me. You know, I think, again, the general public now, although sometimes I feel that we can be a bit sidelined by that, by our content, our social media content, you know, the algorithms of the people who follow us, etc. We can sometimes get this little, because if you talk to my 88-year-old grandmother who's sitting in her little council house up the road, she certainly wouldn't say, you know, we should make drugs, you know, stop prohibiting drugs. So, but I think, yeah, the police, you know, I think they are probably the people that need to be at the forefront of drug policy reform, because they're the ones who see on a daily basis how this is just not working, what we're doing.
Meg, a few clinics have been set up, haven't they, throughout Britain?
So we haven't got an operating drug consumption room at this moment in time, but we are working. And, you know, one of the reasons that Peter now works for us at Cranston is because he's the guy, the only guy, who's actually delivered a form of a drug consumption room across the UK. And we are really passionate and working with as many people as possible, politicians across the whole of the UK, to see where we can deliver this in a way that will, you know, have the support and all of the necessary agreements in place that exist in pretty much every other European country to deliver a drug consumption room. And actually, you know, that includes all of the, you know, kind of clinical oversight and support and that. But this is long overdue, and it needs to happen consistently. And there needs to be drug consumption rooms in, you know, most of our cities, and priority really is somewhere like Glasgow as well.
I think Steve Rolls told me that a few have opened up, and I think maybe Middlesbrough, he said something's opened up or something, and the police are turning a blind eye to it or something.
So that will be the heroin assisted treatment model, right, which is supported by government, which is a slightly different model in that it is prescribed. So diamorphine, which is the medical grade heroin, essentially, that you would potentially have in a hospital scenario, is prescribed in a clinical environment. It completely removes the illegal market, and people who are basically going to that clinic sometimes on a daily basis, sometimes twice a day, and they will inject within that environment using the medical grade diamorphine. And as part of that, that also means that all of the other things, so going back to that being very person-centered and recognizing lots of other support structures, it will also be about linking into other services and support that person might need whilst their stability is got back on track with that diamorphine.
Yeah, for anyone who thinks that's an insane idea to actually let people go to a clinic and take free drugs. I think the stats in Switzerland, 80% of people came off the drug because, yeah, I suppose it's they're offered help. And yeah, I imagine it's one of the first times people are actually caring about you. Is that how it works, Peter?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was certainly what we've seen in Glasgow, you know, that the engagement levels just go up straight away because it's a little bit of support, a little bit of dignity, and a little bit of respect. And I think, you know, you're right to mention the Switzerland model. You know, we often talk about the Portuguese model of decriminalisation, where in actual fact, the reason that I work for Cranston now is we want to do everything that we can currently within legal frameworks to progress things. And what we can do, a lot of that falls within the Switzerland model, the four pillars model, you know, diamorphine assisted treatment. You know, these are the sorts of things that we can be delivering now, you know, and until such a time as the legal frameworks and things do change with the Misuse of Drugs Act, we all need to be doing everything we can to push that forward in terms of drug checking services. I believe that we can operate these sites with the, in terms of overdose prevention sites, safer injecting facilities within the legal framework as well. So we need to push these forward because change only comes through action, as far as I'm concerned.
The word you used there, which I pick up on, is dignity. And I imagine that gets taken away once you become dependent on hard drugs. Not only the taking of them down an alleyway rather than a safe place, but also I imagine the purchasing of them must come with... I'm sure it's not the nicest experience, is it, having to go and buy the drugs off the sort of people who sell them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not one for you know, putting down drug dealers. I think that, you know, in some ways we should have given them essential worker status through the pandemic. Actually, you know, most people that sell drugs at a street level are simply feeding their own dependency, you know, and maybe making enough money to keep electric in their flat or buy themselves some food. You know, obviously we've got the criminal gangs at the top controlling these chains of, you know, distribution, which are making lots of money, and that's the area that, you know, we need to break down with safe supply. And that's what diamorphine really does, you know, diamorphine assisted treatment. You know, the benefits to the people who are actually using drugs are massive, but the benefits to society through cost saving is even just as high, you know, because we're no longer having people having to go out and commit inquisitive crime to feed their dependency. You know, antisocial behaviour drops, you know, people revolving in and out of the criminal justice system. You know, we're saving so much of the taxpayers' money by delivering the health-led approach to people who have problematic substance issues. But yeah, it's not nice having to run about all day, you know, and sit in the street begging, you know, to get £10 to go and buy a bit of heroin or, you know, a rock of crack cocaine. And, you know, that degradation that can often come with that real low-level street drug use is horrible, you know. It is a horrible situation to be in. So that's why we need these approaches, Tim. You know, we're desperate for it now, you know, more so in Scotland, you know, and even more so in Scotland than anywhere else. You know, what I've seen in Glasgow, sometimes it was like being in a war-torn country. You know, I would see people coming along to the ambulance with wheelchairs who had already lost legs to injecting drug use, people with prosthetic legs. I remember having to take £80 out of the GoFundMe page to go and buy a wheelchair for somebody because they were sitting outside Tesco's for weeks begging in a wheelchair with the front wheel missing it, a wheelchair with three wheels. You know, it was absolutely, you know, it drove me to the point where, you know, I just couldn't cope with what I was seeing on a daily basis out there, you know, like some of the pictures that I could refer back to from some of the reporters that attended and reported on it. Just horrific, absolutely horrific.
How do you feel though, mentally after, I suppose, because in one hand you're doing so much good and offering these people some dignity, as you say, and some help. And another way, you're actually seeing such misery, I suppose. How does it make you feel?
Well, see, a lot of what I seen was misery when I wasn't there. You know, what I seen when I was there in a nice hot ambulance, well lit, good heating system. People could do, basic harm reduction. I seen somebody who was a regular groin injector. We were parked in the snow, coming into the ambulance, moving from injecting in their groin to injecting in their arm. You know, that is basic harm reduction. You know, injecting in your arm is so much safer than injecting in your neck or injecting in your groin. You know, so that basic harm reduction, I would see, like, in the back of the ambulance, and this may sound strange, but little type of mutual aid type meetings in the back of the ambulance. So people kind of, drug users helping each other, you know, and talking about the drugs that were safe and where the best place to get them was, you know. And what I seen was uplifting in many ways, but it was the driving away, knowing that I could only be there a certain amount of time. And every time I drove away, somebody was at risk again. There was a young woman who was 20 years old when I first started operating the service. She turned 21. She overdosed on a couple of different occasions, and I was out operating 3 or 4 days a week, but I knew she was injecting every day of the week, multiple times, and every single day I drove that van away, I was highly concerned about if she was going to be alive the next day when I drove back in.
Meg, there's a lot of violence, isn't there, and abuse around these things. Actually, just picking up on a point Peter just said there, it's funny, you see Alcoholics Anonymous, they'll all sit around and talk and support each other. And you see mental health now, it's regular listeners of this all know that I've had depression and go back 15 years, I wouldn't talk about it on TV. Now everyone would praise me for doing it. I try not to do it too much because I'm there to entertain people, not tell them about my thing. But I talk about it a lot on the podcast, and I can talk about it. But it seems that if you're dependent on hard drugs, it's not something you're allowed to talk about to other people, is it? I think that's half the cure, don't you, Meg?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And actually, one of the things that I would say about the overlap there is that, I think it's fantastic that we've got to a better place as society in terms of talking about mental health, because there is a huge overlap between mental health and substance use as well, of course. But actually, I think that has also been where we have seen a shift in people understanding substance use addiction, whether that be alcohol or other drugs, and that's really important, because I think people start to see this as a health issue rather than a criminal justice one, and certainly before I came to Cranston working for the West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner, there's a real movement by policing and police and crime commissioners, a number of them across England and Wales, who wanted to take a different approach, who recognised that this should be seen as a health issue, not criminal justice one. But also practically again and pragmatically, which is, we're filling up custody suites and prisons with people that have a mental health problem, actually, or a substance use problem. We're not helping those people. So our approach is very different. It's about getting in at the front end. It's about, so for example, in the West Midlands, we have a arrest referral service, which is in every police custody station in the West Midlands. And we engage with people who come in for lots of different crime types, and we look at what the root cause of that criminality is. So for example, when COVID came about in 2020, through 2020, that team assessed over 2,500 people coming through custody, and 1,000 of those people were not engaged with local drug and alcohol treatment providers. They were not getting any help, and most of them did want some support from treatment providers. So we supported and helped those people into local treatment where they wanted that kind of support. And that's it, that starts to reduce the number of people going into prison, because what we do instead is work with probation and other services to support those people and have court orders that are issued instead of short-term sentences. So, you know, not just from a kind of a viewpoint of, you know, how it's viewed, but from a really practical, pragmatic sense, it's, you know, it just makes complete sense to do this in this way, to treat people as people first and foremost, but also to stop the kind of cost demand of, you know, the criminal justice system, which should be there to keep people safe. And at the moment is overwhelmingly, you know, our prisons, you know, if we took the American approach, for example, it should be the safest country in the world, but they have the highest rates of, you know, imprisonment and incarceration in the world, and it hasn't helped. So let's not keep going down that approach. Let's do something different. And that's what we started to do. Mm. And that service in the West Midlands saves £15 million per annum to the taxpayer. And that's a kind of conservative figure. So this is a huge approach which just needs to be scaled up and across the whole country now, really.
Yeah, we're spending an absolute fortune, aren't we, on policing this? If anyone's interested, by the way, I did a podcast with Steve Rolls not so long ago. I can't remember what number it is now, but that's a really good podcast for someone explaining how it would work with drug reform, where people would get their drugs and how you would see it in society. It's not as crazy as you think, though, because you can go into a pub and order whatever form of alcohol you want, and you can go and buy cigarettes from lots of places. Interestingly, New Zealand are just about to make cigarettes illegal. You're like, what? What haven't they learned? I mean, what? What? This is crazy. So they're just going to make a black market for cigarettes. And actually, if you don't have empathy for the people using the drugs, you've got to understand that the costs of this industry. I mean, you're talking about people, the people selling the drugs on the street. They're doing it to support their own habits, but the people supplying it are getting more and more violent, as Neil Woods explained to me on this podcast. The violence is escalating. We've got Ross Kemp doing a documentary on whether we should arm the police with bloody machine guns and stuff soon, or whatever it is they want. He wants every policeman, or he was talking about getting. It's like, you can prevent this if we stop the violence escalating. The reason why it's violent is because it's illegal. So, you know, that even if you've got no empathy for people who use drugs, have empathy for society and the rise of violence going on out there. This is true, right?
Yeah. And I think there's a fantastic, so the chief constable who used to be at Durham, I'll borrow with pride his phrase because I think it explains it really well. But Mike Barton talked on, and I think it was on Question Time actually, a couple of years ago, about the fact that policing have created a kind of Darwinian cycle of violence. And Neil Woods talks very eloquently, probably much more eloquently than I could, about this as well. But, you know, you are, when policing are going in and disturbing markets, you know, the impact of that is for, you know, Peter explained the impact of people who are using drugs finding safe supply. That has a real, so we see drug-related deaths increasing actually when a market is disrupted in that way. But also another organised crime group comes in to take over that area of the market and fights with other organised crime groups to do so. So, you know, it's about that market share. It's about, you know, any other business model, really. And when we talk about county lines, you know, we have to look at, you know, the particularly children, young people who are being drawn into county lines. But also what we really need to do is focus on the fact that the commodity of all of this is drugs. And unless we really tackle that element of it, you know, unfortunately, young people are going to continue to be drawn into that horrible, you know, exploitation. And, you know, we've got to be able to tackle that in a way that says, let's try and reduce the demand side of that, not just keep going after, you know, kind of police-led operations.
And Peter, one of the biggest problems is you never know what you're taking, do you? You don't know what's in the substance because it's not regulated. So I think I read this over the Christmas period that there's no MDMA in MDMA anymore. It's just, I don't know what they're taking, but it's just become such a popular drug amongst the youth that it's just nothing. I don't know what it is now, speed or something. I just don't know. But apparently that has become just a ridiculous drug now for the kids. They have literally no idea what they're taking unless they take test kits with them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm not sure if you've seen the report yesterday of the young 16-year-old who died from taking MDMA. And you know, that's the challenges that young people face. You know, our friends were, you know, obviously young people experimenting with substances, scared to call for help in case they got into trouble. You know, and that is a direct result of these prohibitive policies that we have.
Yeah, let me just tell people who didn't read that they have their friends waited 2 hours while she was overdosing because they were too scared they were going to get in trouble. And if they'd got her to help to a hospital in those 2 hours, she would have been fine, right? That's basically what they're saying, or she would have stood more chance of living, which is just such a horrible situation for those. The impact on the children who didn't take her to the hospital, now they've got to live with that for the rest of their life too.
Exactly, yeah. And it's like that across the board. You know, we just don't know what we're taking. You know, there is so many dangers ahead that lie ahead for the UK in the coming years. You know, we've got the Afghanistan currently going on at the moment. You know, with the Taliban, we don't know what's going to happen with opium production, whether that's going to dip more into methamphetamines, whether production is, or supply out of that country is going to be impacted, which could raise the chances of synthetic opioids finding their way into the market, things like fentanyl, which is responsible primarily for North American overdose crisis. You know, I think they had over 100,000 deaths last year from overdoses, primarily due to these synthetics, which are 50 times stronger, up to 100 times stronger, actually, than our current supply of street heroin. And one of the things that we need to point to with the new drug strategy, although there's been a lot of an extra investment with the new drug strategy, which is great for organisations like ourselves who want to deliver these evidence-based ways of supporting people. We also have to look at the other side, the continued war on drugs side of the strategy. You know, we had an international lockdown, you know, where we couldn't travel in and out of the country, you know, borders completely closed down. And at the start of that lockdown, I was working with Release Drugs and Transform Drug Policy Foundation, and we were looking and monitoring the drug market, thinking that there would be disruption to the supply. There was absolutely no disruption to the supply.
Wow.
Despite not being able to travel in and out of the country, despite through that time, the police still doing what they do in terms of chasing down and trying to disrupt county lines, etc. If we can't stop drugs at that point, we're never going to stop drugs. We need to completely reverse and renew what we're doing. I think most politicians now are starting to see the need for reform. I think the biggest one for me is Keir Starmer. You know, I would love if Keir Starmer started to look at drug policy reform in a way that's up to date and in line with what most organisations are saying.
Peter, he's already said, because he disappointed me, because I thought, well, at least he can take a different, you know, he can do something. He's already said there's not a chance that he's going to look at drug reform. And I think that might be because he spent so much time, because he's a lawyer, isn't he, a solicitor,
yeah.
And he spent so much time putting these people away that it would make everything, it would devalue or his legacy of what he's achieved. And I worry if it is because of that. And Boris Johnson recently has come out and said that, you know, they're worried about drug trafficking in Afghanistan and everything, blah, 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 blah. So he's clearly narcotics. He was talking about the other day. And he clearly is not got the appetite for it. Do we feel there's anyone out there, the politicians across party or anything happening that could change? Meg, you're shaking your head, nodding your head. Sorry. Do you think that,
I was going to say there's some fantastic, and completely cross-party, you know, when you look at both the Labour and Conservative campaigns for drug reform and, you know, much wider than, you know, Scotland, SNP, and Peter can probably perhaps talk more on that, but Green Party, Liberal Democrats, there's much more happening. But unfortunately, as you quite rightly point out, it's not necessarily happening at that, you know, leadership and cabinet, shadow cabinet level. But there is a lot of momentum, and, you know, we can only do it in that way when it is cross-party, when it's evidence informed, when it's, you know.
Sadly, there seems to be much more appeal for strong on crime than empathy with people. This seems to be much bigger, better selling point. We're strong on crime, seems to be, you know, and I think drug users or drug dependency people are easy targets on that.
And unfortunately, you know, that kind of, you know, tough on crime or tough on justice, it doesn't get, you know, it doesn't get justice for victims, actually, which is should be a really key part of this. It doesn't get justice for victims. But also, the approaches that we as a charity are proving work are fantastic for the people involved, but they're also fantastic for the taxpayer because they're reducing the costs. So, you know, and also fantastic for policing demand. So the more that we can keep advocating and supporting and sharing the evidence that us and others are pulling together, the more that we'll start to change that.
So what's the charity's aim is to raise awareness, is it?
So raise awareness, but we're also delivering. So, you know, one of the things that Peter said earlier and one of our ambitions is, yes, we are campaigning for greater change, but that doesn't stop us getting on doing things that we can do now within the existing legal framework. So diversion, engagement in the criminal justice system, trying to break that cycle of crime by supporting people away from that. And then, you know, we deliver a number of substance use services at a local level across England currently. And so we're also, the fantastic thing is that we're also able to prove that concept. We're able to deliver the evidence, we're able to show what the impact is when these things really work. And our diversion scheme, which is for young people, so much feedback and you know, people that have said, for example, a midwife that went on that course, and she said, you know, if she'd have been treated through the normal criminal justice route, that possibly would have been the end of her, you know, midwife career. And you know, this is where you start to see the impact that it has on people's future life chances and opportunities. And actually, we all benefit from that, not just the individual, but us as a society.
Peter, what's next for you? How are you moving things on?
Well, I mean, obviously, now with Cransdown, I am hoping that we can continue to break those barriers. You know, we can continue to deliver everything that we can physically right now within the legal frameworks. Like Meg said, you know, the divert is absolutely fantastic. It can divert people away from the criminal justice system who really don't need to be in the criminal justice system. Also, people who don't need to be in drug treatment systems, you know, they're simply stopped and searched and caught in possession of small amounts of substances. They don't need to be in a drug treatment system. They simply maybe need a little bit of an education. You know, and if we can deliver those sorts of services UK-wide, that really shows what can be done, you know, in terms of, you know, breaking that cycle and giving people the support that they need. You know, drug consumption rooms are obviously my passion. You know, I've visited other drug consumption rooms in other areas, you know, and that I would love to be at the forefront of that. And I know as an organisation, you know, we've got the ability to deliver that. You know, we've got the blueprint. We understand how it can be delivered within current legal frameworks. So as soon as that go-ahead's given, we can come in and deliver a safer injecting facility or overdose prevention centre in any part of the United Kingdom, you know. So that's the things I love to do, campaigning constantly for political reform. Just going back quickly to Keir Starmer, he was in Scotland while I was operating my overdose prevention centre from the ambulance, and I contacted every single journalist that I could in order to find out where he was when he said he didn't support these and he thought drug policy was just about right. And I was driving around Glasgow trying to find him in my ambulance so I could ask him what he thought about everybody that I was supporting and the things that they were saying. But nobody let us know. All the journalists that I have contacts with, nobody could find out where he was going to be for his photo shoot. But that's the frustrating thing, I suppose, from a UK level. You know, in Scotland, we have really wide cross-party support at a high level of government, you know, to reform, to decriminalise, and that's small pockets of support across the UK governments. But I always point people, although I'm not a political party member of any party, I always point people to the Green, the UK Green Party stance on drug policy, which if you look online and you look at that, that for me is the ideal stance.
Just give us the highlights of that then. What do they say?
They talk about an end to prohibition, about a regulated right. market. Yeah, okay. Essentially most people who understand the harms associated yeah. with current policy are campaigning for.
These MPs are not stupid. And if they listen to the arguments, they will understand it. The sad thing is, well, so idealistic. I always thought that MPs were there just to do the best job for the country. When you sort of, I don't know, I ended up, it was after I read Tony Blair's book, I suddenly realized it was just a power game. And it's like, it's got very little to do with what's right for the, I mean, the emphasis is sort of there for doing what's right for the country, but it's also trying to stay in power and try and keep your own job when your chancellor's trying to steal it or whatever. And it's a very strange, so there's got to be a great appetite for the whole country to want to, you know, like when the Tories, I think, got through gay marriage, which is incredible, really. But the appetite was there. The country went, yeah, we're up for this. And so they were able to put it through. We need to get the people to be, they'll soon jump on board if they think it's a vote winner, won't they? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's a fantastic, one of the things that, having worked for a politician in the West Midlands and David Jameson, who was the previous Police and Crime Commissioner in the West Midlands, also had experience at, you know, a high level of government. And, a phrase that he said struck with me, I'm sure he won't mind me sharing it, which is, you know, any politician really worth their weight should be two steps ahead and they should be bringing the public with them. But if they're too far ahead, they can't see the public. And that's key, really, is that, you know, there's a real leadership role in there, and that you do have to bring people with you sometimes, and how that plays out. And unfortunately, I think there is a very careful kind of view, and I don't think necessarily that, you know, it is two steps ahead at the moment. I think it's a bit more sort of two steps behind in relation to drug policy. And that's just what we need to catch up on as well. Drug policy is one of those issues which seems to be polarized. You're either hard on drugs or you're soft on drugs. And that's why we're really trying hard to carve this space in the middle that says, let's just look at what works. You know, so our ambition as a charity is to look across the world at world-class services, evidence-informed solutions, bring them back to the UK and say, you know, this is what we should be doing, and try and just carve that middle space to have those sensible, grown-up conversations about drug policy instead.
So, Meg, if people want to get involved with your charity, how would they go about finding you and seeking what you do?
So the best place to go is probably the website, which is cranston.org. And we're also on every social media platform as well. So Facebook, Twitter, etc. to engage.
I should just say Cranston, spelled C-R-A-N-S-T-O-U-N. That's how it's spelled.
That's correct, yes. Yeah. And always looking for volunteers as well. And there'll be some fantastic and exciting opportunities coming over the next sort of 12 months for volunteers.
Volunteer to do what?
I'll hand over to Peter on that.
So towards the end of this month, hopefully beginning of next month, we're looking to launch an app which will be called the Buddy Up app. And that will be downloadable across the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland, and people will be able to app to app call. So at the moment, we have most people who are obviously having fatal overdoses or using drugs on their own. So rather than using drugs on their own, they'll be able to download the app, connect in with one of our volunteers. The volunteer will, if the person becomes unresponsive, be able to activate an emergency response to get emergency services or a local emergency contact out to essentially save that person's life. We're also looking to have information for, generally on there for legal advice, drugs, naloxone, and just the basic go-to place for harm reduction. So people will be able to come along and hopefully volunteer in those roles.
Amazing. Peter, Meg, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been enlightening, to say the least. Just one final question for both of you. When Steve Rolls was on the podcast, I got the general opinion that he believed it wasn't would it happen or wouldn't happen. It was a matter of time, how long it would take. Do you two think that's what's going to happen, that it is, we're going to have drug reform, we're going to end this prohibition on drugs? Meg, you're nodding your head again, so I assume you agree with that.
Yes, I do. And I think even if you look at, and you've interviewed some of them previously, but some of the passionate, incredible people working in this field who are, you know, bringing back evidence, and, you know, people like, really fortunate to have, you know, Peter with us at Cranston, who has actually just got on and delivered some of this stuff. I think, you know, even one person can change things, as Peter's proven. So I'm incredibly optimistic that we will see drug reform.
Peter, if people want to contact you, are you on social media?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. That's my main social media account that I use. I'm starting to do a little bit of TikTok as well, but that's a whole range of dancing type stuff on there.
What are you under? What's your name there? Is it just is it just your name there?
It's Pete rather than Peter, so it's Pete Crycant and underscore OPC, which stands for Overdose Prevention Centre.
Right, and he spells his surname is spelled, not he spells it, that sounds ridiculous. His surname is spelled KRYKANT. Guys, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.